Hello, everybody. Thanks for attending this talk. I want to talk about the relationship between ontic structural realism and quantum mechanics. And the thing I want to say at the outset maybe is, I think a lot of the time in philosophy of physics or philosophy of science, people kind of take quantum mechanics as a proxy for quantum physics. And that's okay up to a point. But we should be really careful about the difference between, I think in general, in philosophy of science and philosophy of physics, the theory and the world, and the physics in the sense of our theories about the world, and the physics in the sense of what happens in the world, right? So if you go back to 20th century philosophy of science, Carnap makes this distinction between the material mode and the formal mode. And when we talk about something like measurement or decoherence or entanglement, we might mean something in the theory. You know, let's take entanglement. I mean, we might mean entangled states, non-product states in a tensor product Hilbert space. But we might mean the thing in the world, the phenomenon, right? And I think it's, you know, it's important that we distinguish between those two things, because quantum mechanics is a theory about quantum physics, but quantum physics began before quantum mechanics and continued afterwards. So that's just sort of a general point, really, about what I mean when I say quantum mechanics here. I think what I really mean is quantum physics, and I've sort of fallen foul of my own stricture to be careful about the distinction between the two. Anyway, let me go on. Now, I say here that ontic structural realism is a form of scientific realism, and I wrote this abstract for this talk. So I was thinking, okay, so I'm talking to an audience of people who are really specialists in quantum mechanics or quantum physics, and I'm talking about ontic structural realism to them. Well, it's not hard for me to make the connection, because ontic structural realism, as I developed it when I started my PhD, well, it came from the work of John Worrell and John Worrell's idea of structural realism. But I was very much thinking about quantum mechanics for two reasons. One, because I was studying with Stephen French, and Stephen French taught me about this debate about individuality and identity and individuality of quantum particles, which I didn't know anything about before. And the other reason is because I just finished my, well, I did my undergraduate degree in pure mathematics, a bit of philosophy, and I did a theoretical physics project on Bell's theorem and action at a distance and so on. This is with Anthony Sudbury a long, long time ago, 1992. And so I was really schooled in quantum physics and had really thought about it to a reasonable extent. And it was very much in my mind when I was trying to think about scientific realism. So how does that actually play out in how we understand, or how ontic structural realism is understood? Well, there's a negative and a positive side to ontic structural realism. And the negative side is the downplaying one way or another of the idea of individuals, and the upplaying one way or another of relational structure. Now, that could take different forms, but I'm just being deliberately loose here, right? So ontic structural realism, one way or another, talks up relations and talks down objects. Whether it completely eliminates objects or not, that's another question, but you know, it definitely talks down individuals compared to relations. And that's really because the idea of individuals is put under pressure by quantum statistics. That's part of it. And then the positive side of ontic structural realism, in my understanding, is an idea of the world having an objective modal structure. And this is mostly about what I want to explain in this talk. But it best exemplified, I think, by entanglement, right? Because what is entanglement, if not modal structure, that doesn't reduce to the intrinsic properties of parts and their causal interactions? So furthermore, I'm here just reading out my abstract, this idea of modal structure is, I think, in ontic structure realism, is, I think, well exemplified by what lots of people at Perimeter are interested in, I think, which is, and lots of people here have been interested in, which is by how the structure of correlations in quantum mechanics sits between Bell inequality violation, but not the violation of not violating the prescription against superluminal signaling, not allowing superluminal signaling. Now, then I've got these further questions here. What should the advocate of OSR say about the measurement problem decoherence? Should we, properly speaking, just, if we believe in OSR, should we just be Everettians? And are Lademan and Ross justified in not agreeing with Wallace about, and Simon Saunders, about the natural connection between structural realism, ontic structural realism, and Everett. Okay, so that, I hope that sets the agenda for what I want to talk about, and I hope that those are all matters of interest to you. Thanks very much to Tom for inviting me, and I just want to thank Steve French and Don Ross, but I want to point out that the kind of structural realism, that kind of ontic structural realism I defend, is not the same as what Steve French defends. But it shares with him. I mean, this goes back to work that we did together as well. This idea of modal structure. So that is in his view and my view and Don's view. I mean, and I want to give some kind of explanation of what that is. Okay, good. Now, you could regard structural realism, philosophy is a wonderful subject, but really annoying, because quite often we just end up arguing about some terminology, really. You know, is structural realism a form of scientific realism, or is it something else? Well, who cares, really? You know, it just depends on how you define scientific realism. And on my view, I'm going to say it is a kind of scientific realism. And it's differentiated, and has been right from my early work, from Van Frassen's structural empiricism by incorporation of a commitment to there being necessity or modal structure to the world. Okay, now Van Frassen just doesn't think there is any such thing. So he's like Hume in that way. You know, famously, and of course Hume exegesis is very contentious, but the Hume, as most people understand him, is a skeptic about whether or not there's any kind of necessity to relations between events. And from him, we get this idea of Humeanism, which is the idea of all there is what happens. And laws of nature are just general claims about what happens. There's nothing making anything happen. There's no necessity. And there may or may not be some idea of objective modality, but it's, if there is, objective modality doesn't consist in there being natural necessity in the world. So, back. So I've always thought of ontic structural realism is trying to take account of several things at once. And I think you need to take account of several things at once, because we want a realist view that's apt for what we know in the 21st century now. And we know lots of things. One thing that we know, most importantly, and this is what motivates structural realism, is that there's been quite radical theory change in the history of science. And in particular, let's just focus for a minute on highly advanced predictive mathematical physics, right? there's been a lot of theory change even there. And so whatever kind of realism we've got has got to take that into account. It's got to take into account that even our best theories can be wrong in some respects, and maybe wrong in quite sort of critical ontological respects, I guess, right? So, I mean, you might think, well, look, suppose that the hypothesis of dark matter is correct, as I think most people think it is. Well, then all of our science and physics has been wrong about what most of matter is. So, you know, within contemporary physics, we have an example of how we might be illustrating this problem of theory change now, by coming to accept that, in fact, you know, we don't really know what most of the matter in the universe is like. But obviously the examples that, that people normally talk about are Newtonian mechanics and Fresnel's elastic solid ether theory, Maxwell's electromagnetism, theories that are highly mathematical, highly predictive, have all the right kind of theoretical virtues that, that realists think compel assent and compel belief. And yet we now think, oh, but they're not right. But there are other things that we want to take account of too. And one of those is the ontology of contemporary physics. And I've already sort of said a little bit about how I think ontic structural realism does that. And another is the fact that I think Van Frassen's position fails because he doesn't have objective modality. Okay, good. So let me say something about why I think objective modality is crucial to the defense of scientific realism in general. And then I'm going to say something about it in the context of ontic structuralism. So everyone will probably know this, I guess, if you haven't heard it, it's an easy thing to explain anyway, this idea of the no miracles argument. And it's usually attributed to Putnam, and Putnam puts it in the following kind of form. If there wasn't really theoretical entities as we think they are, then it would be completely mysterious how our science is so successful. Indeed, it would be miraculous how our science is so successful. But it's actually a much older form of argument than just coming from Putnam. And I like to cite scientists on this kind of thing. So Huygens stresses successful novel prediction and multiple lines of confirmation in the preface to his work on optics. William Ewell says, the consilience of inductions takes place when an induction obtained from one class of facts coincides with an induction obtained from another class. This consilience is the test of the truth of the theory in which it occurs. And then more recently, people have talked about triangulation, the idea that you want multiple lines of evidence in order to give the best kind of confirmation for a theory. Now, of course, we've seen this in most obviously in Newton, right? That I think what really makes Newton's achievements so great and what makes his theory so compelling is the way that it unifies terrestrial and extraterrestrial physics and already known kinematical laws like from Galileo and Kepler. So Herschel says here, 1830, the surest and best characteristic of a well-founded and extensive induction is when verifications of it spring up, as it were, spontaneously from quarters where they might be least expected. Evidence of this kind is irresistible and compels assent. So there's this thought that where we have successful novel prediction and, more importantly, multiple lines of evidence all confirming the same theory, that theory must be true, but we've got the problem of theory change. The problem of theory change premised on the actual historical record, and it shows that not even the very best theories are all completely true by the lights of our current science. And this problem is often framed in terms of the abandonment of central theoretical terms like caloric, ether, and phlogiston. But that's not really the crux of the problem. Why is that? Well, consider the relationship between classical and quantum physics, or between Newtonian and relativistic physics. It's not about us abandoning terms. We still use the terms momentum, wavelength, mass, space-time. No, that's not the problem. And from our current perspective, if we take the ether, where we don't use the term anymore, and atom, where we do, well, actually, the ether has much more in common with the field than atoms do, the atoms that we believe in do with the indivisible particles of antiquity. Right? So it's really an accident whether we keep using the same word or when we still use the word. So we're not really interested in that, but how can we respond to this problem of theory change? Well, Heinz Post in 1971 formulated something called the general correspondence principle. He said, Kuhn was wrong, Thomas Kuhn was wrong. There just aren't any cases, said Post, of well-confirmed empirical laws being abandoned. In fact, they're retained by their successors as approximations within certain domains. And I think this is how physicists think about past theories all the time. It's really obvious to most physicists. And this is why I think there's a massive misunderstanding between the more generally educated population and the scientifically educated population, that the generally educated population have kind of learned that Newton thought a load of stuff and it was all wrong and it was replaced by Einstein, right? And that's not how we think about it in physics at all. We think, right, what are the domains in which Newtonian mechanics is still valid, and how can we recover the well-confirmed parts of how can we recover the structure of Newtonian mechanics from classical mechanics in the right regime? And obviously, when we do that, we're going to be correcting the old theory. We don't recover Newtonian mechanics at all in some regimes. But for the vast majority of cases, as we all know, it's still incredibly accurate. So how can we incorporate this idea of continuity between past theories and present theories despite radical changes in ontology? And it's kind of easy for an empiricist or an anti-realist, because they can just say, well, you just got these empirically adequate laws and then you've got corrections to them, it's no big deal. But how can we incorporate this insight into a defense of realism? Now, I just want to say here that this is a really important point about Poincaré's metaphor about science being ruins built on ruins. And the critical idea here is that the ground is not cleared before the new work begins. The old theories are sort of built into and part of the new theories. So the key point from a point of view of realism, according to me, is more than the empirical content and phenomenological laws of these past theories is retained. So in particular, say, it's not just the kinematical laws that are preserved as limiting cases of general relativity, not just sort of the phenomenological laws, you might think. I don't know if I'm using kinematical the way you'd use it here. But you can certainly see, Kepler's laws, Galileo's laws are kind of phenomenological, right? How do the planets move? How does a pendulum move? Whereas Newton's inverse square law is the explanation of those phenomena. And it's a theoretical law, but it's not, we don't go from general relativity straight to the phenomena, we go via the inverse square law as a low energy limit in the form of the Poisson equation, but still. So there's a sense in which the theoretical structure is part of what's retained, not just the empirical consequences. Now, the laws take mathematical form and there are special cases, and that's what John Worrell wrote about. So John Worrell wrote about the case of Fresnel's equations, where you take the very same equations and you reinterpret them. And that's fine, but that is really a special case. That's not the norm. in many cases, mathematical structure is lost or radically modified, but there's still some kind of preservation. So I guess a good example would be something like Ehrenfest's theorem, where, you know, it's giving you continuity with a law that it gives you something that looks like a law in classical physics, but it's directly relating expectation values of operators, which don't appear at all in classical physics. So it's not mathematically the same, kind of homologous, right? And you can show that the homology of that law relates to the correspondence limit, the limiting correspondence between the classical and the quantum. So ontic structural realism certainly doesn't require that all mathematical structure is preserved on theory change. That would be mad, right? We know that we get new structure. That's not the point. The point is to identify more that's retained than just the empirical content. That's the point. And I call it modal structure. So I want to say something about what I mean by that. And I'm basically going to use here two examples, and I've almost certainly run out of time before I even started. So I'm going to pick one example which isn't from physics and isn't mathematical, and then I'm going to go to quantum mechanics. So in the 20th century, Thomas Kuhn and Paul Feyerabend popularized the view that theory change in the history of science disrupts narratives of continuous progress. And so what lots of philosophers of science did was exactly what they should have done. They went and looked at the history and see if the history really supported what Kuhn and Feyerabend were saying. And like the case of phlogiston theory a great deal, it's a good case. One, because it's not from physics, it doesn't involve maths. Two, because it's one of the three most central examples of a scientific revolution according to Thomas Kuhn. So Noretta Kurtiger looked at phlogiston theory and she said, well, actually, kind of doesn't undermine the realist position at all, or at least the correspondence principle, because well-confirmed empirical regularities stated in terms of phlogiston theory are true when translated into the language of oxygen. So what do I mean by that? Well, in the language of oxygen, if you burn a candle in a bell jar until the candle goes out, then you've deoxygenated the air in the bell jar. And that explains why a mouse in that bell jar will no longer be able to breathe. Why? Well, because breathing is respiration, which is a form of oxidation, and there's no oxygen in the bell jar. Now, in the phlogiston theory, this would be put in the following terms. The air is saturated with phlogiston after the candle is burned out, and air saturated with phlogiston doesn't support respiration. But what's important is this: there's this common connection between different processes, burning and respiration, and common retained statements of necessity and possibility, right? Like, it will be impossible for the mouse to breathe in that jar. That comes out as a true implication of oxygen theory, but it's also a true implication of phlogiston theory. And when I talk about modal structure, what I mean is, on the one hand, claims of necessity and possibility. So it will be impossible for the mouse to breathe in that jar. On the other hand, the whatever it is that warrants us in stating counterfactuals, like if you hadn't put the mouse in the jar, it would still be alive. If the moon, so to take a more scientific, a more physics example, if the moon, if we didn't have a moon, Earth's orbit would be less stable. Right, that's a counterfactual claim, and it's just as true on general relativity as it was on Newtonian gravitation. And you know, if you think about ordinary claims that you might make about why a bridge collapsed, right? That bridge wouldn't have collapsed if the engineers had done X, Y, Z, right? Then whatever Newtonian physics kind of informed you in making these counterfactual claims, or if you made a causal claim about why the bridge did collapse, not to say why it wouldn't have collapsed if, but rather to say it did collapse because, those kinds of claims are all going to be still just as warranted as they were before we learned about quantum mechanics and general relativity, right? So insofar as we know about the modal structure of the world through Newtonian mechanics, well, we still do to an extent. Of course, we haven't retained everything because there's all sorts of claims you would make on the basis of Newtonian mechanics, like this is what would happen if we accelerated this particle to half the speed of light, and those will be wrong, right? But still, what's retained is more than just empirical content or actual facts. This is what I would regard as a kind of claim about modal structure as an example. Combustion, respiration, and calcination of metals are all the same kind of process and is an inverse kind of process. And that claim is true on the light by the lights of both phlogiston theory and oxygen theory, even though there's no such thing as phlogiston. The tables of affinity and antipathy of phlogistic chemistry express real patterns that we now express in terms of reducing and oxidizing power. So the thought is the examples from mathematical physics and the case of phlogiston theory show that even though the ontology of science might change quite radically at the level of objects and properties, so there's no elastic solid ether, there's no phlogiston, there's no caloric, there can be continuity of the modal structure that's attributed to the world. So another example, the Carnot cycle. Carnot cycle is developed in the context of the theory of caloric. There is no caloric, but the Carnot cycle is part of the modal structure of the world. At least I think it is, but I only think that because I defer to physics. Okay, good. So I'm gonna just sort of skip quickly over this, but I just wanna say that because a lot of what I do is sort of try to dispel misunderstandings of structuralism. Structuralism is not a kind of selective realism. We're trying to pick in advance the bits that will be retained and then hold on, believe those now, and then they'll be still true in the future. So we're not doing that. What we're doing is giving a response to the argument from theory change that says, you shouldn't believe anything about your theories beyond what's just in, what's their predictions are because of successive theories are likely to contradict it. And the response is, no, successive theories will still preserve lots of the structure of those theories. They will preserve lots of the modal structure. They will preserve lots of the theoretical structure, not just lots of the empirical predictions. I mean, doing those things is kind of the same thing because, you know, theories are only able to make multiple predictions because you can put in different initial conditions and they've got laws, they give you out, they give you a relationship of necessity between or at least of some kind of relationship, even a probabilistic relationship. They give you a modal relationship between inputs and outputs that constrain the space of what's possible. And that's a large part, you know, how they work. I mean, that's what we do. Good. So the idea is not to kind of look at the standard model and say, oh, the structure will be retained. So let's just work out what the structure is and then we'll know. Right? It's not it. The point is, though, that we should expect that when we ultimately improve on the standard model or replace the standard model or whatever, we're still going to think there's an approximate U1 symmetry in electromagnetism, and we're still going to think that there's an approximate U2 symmetry in the electroweak force when the symmetry isn't broken to the U1. And, you know, we're still going to think that there's much more besides. Now, you might say we're still going to think much more besides that isn't structural. Like we're still going to think that the mass of the electron is roughly what it is. And I think I'd agree with that as well. Okay, so I think given that I've already been talking for a while, I'm sure I've said enough to provoke you some questions. I'm just going to get on to talking about quantum mechanics. So Theories like Newtonian mechanics and Lee literally false as fundamental physics, but still capture important modal structure and relation. So that's just to say that, you know, wait, this is what we've always been saying. Good. So I have a slide. Oh, yes. So quantum mechanics. No. Yes. So I just have to find the right side in it. Yeah, so consider the example of entanglement. So here's how I think you might say that the idea of modal structure and it helps us understand what we're learning from quantum mechanics. So when we study quantum mechanics at the level of studying violation of Bell inequalities, and especially if you sort of move to the framework of PR boxes or something like that, or generalized probability theories, then you start thinking, well, forget about all the stuff that quantum mechanics tells us about spin and angular momentum and all of that. And let's just think about the structure of correlations between measurements, right, on jointly prepared states. And it turns out that there's something systematic we can say there. We can say systematically that classical theories obey Bell inequalities and quantum mechanics doesn't. Now, the Bell inequalities just are relations between correlation functions, right? Correlation is a modal notion. We're not talking about, we have to assume that when we make measurements, we're sampling in such a way that our relative frequencies give us a rough guide to real probability. If we think that all that happens is just what actually happens, then there's nothing to explain in Bell inequality violation. I mean, I set the X and you set X and I get up and you get down. I mean, so what? The problem only comes about if you want to explain how I could predict that if I'd set it to Y and so had you, you would get the opposite of what I got, right? That's the issue. It's all to do with what would happen if you'd made a different measurement. That's why in the proof of the Bell inequalities, we don't get a proof, I'm sorry, proof of violation of the Bell inequalities, proof of Bell's theorem. We don't get a proof unless we can say things like the settings on one side are independent of the settings on the other. Right? What do we mean by that? Modally independent. That's what we mean by independent there. Causally independent, modally independent, however we want to put it. So the very idea that we've learned something profound when we've learned that quantum physics, and here I'm going to talk about quantum physics because I think, you know, we are saying something more general now. We know that quantum field theory isn't going to undo this. You know, quantum field theory just as much predicts the violation of Bell inequalities as ordinary quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Or as I tell my students, non-relativistic many-particle quantum mechanics, right? Because that's what lots of philosophers often mean by quantum. We've learned something really general at the level of the structure of correlations between measurements. And then we further learn that we still can't signal faster than light. And so we know that the modal structure of the world is between signaling faster than light and Bell inequality violation. And then the whole point of the PR boxes approach is to show that it is conceivable to have a physics where there's more Bell inequality violation than we see in quantum mechanics, but still not so much that we would be able to violate no signaling. So I think all of this is very well understood as seeing how quantum physics constrains or describes the modal structure of the world at quite a general level. And we know that pure entangled states always make for violation of a Bell-type inequality. And so, I say, you know, what such violation amounts to is that the relative frequencies for repeated measurements do not accord with the correlation functions derived from local hidden variable models. You all know that. So one can say, look, Bell's theorem and its generalization are not about quantum mechanics. What are they about then? Well, they're about the modal structure of the world. And quantum mechanics is, in a way, what we can say is, through Bell's theorem, we've learned what quantum mechanics is telling us about the modal structure of the world, namely the modal structure of the world is non-classical. Good. Now, I've no idea whether a research program which seeks to kind of focus on that as an abstraction away from all the physics, this abstract character of entanglement, will give us new physics. Nothing I'm saying here is predicated on the idea that PR boxes or generalized probability theories or whatever will. But I am saying that what's really going on there is the direct application of from physics to studying the modal structure of the world. Good. So, I mean, there's so many more things that I could talk about. And I suppose I'll just finish off by saying something about this. I mean, it's not like I should be pushing an open door here, I would have thought. I mean, modal notions are just all over science. Scientific journals are awash with causal claims. But importantly, especially in physics, you know, probability statistics are everywhere. They are, probability is one of the modalities according to Aristotle. It's not determined by what's actual, you know, in the same way that whether or not something is possible is not determined by the fact that it didn't happen. I mean, it didn't happen, but it might still have been possible. Well, something may have happened or not happened, and that tells us nothing about what its probability was. Unlikely things happen and likely things don't happen. So actuality, you know, the modal is what goes beyond the actual, and probability does that. I think that the idea of computation and information are modal notions, and that's not my idea. Tim Maudlin pointed out a long time ago, the idea of information is modal. I can send you a message by sending you a one or a zero, only if you know what the message would have been if I'd sent zero. And if I send you one, you only know something because you know what zero would have meant. And with computation, I mean, I've written quite a lot about this in a different context. What are the truth conditions for saying that physical system P implemented computation C? It can't be just the actual history of physical system P. Because to know that a computation has been carried out, we need to know that the actual history would have been appropriately different were we to have given the system its different setup. So just give you an example. What makes it true that an AND gate computes AND is not that on some one occasion we put in inputs of a bit more than 3 volts into each input and we got an output of more than 3 volts. Right, that doesn't tell us anything. We need to know that if one of those inputs had not been near 3 volts, the output wouldn't have been 3 volts. Otherwise, it's not true. Otherwise, it just did something. It didn't do a computation. And more generally in science, you know, there's these classes of explanation that don't fit well into laws or causes, but do fit well into this idea of modal structure. So Elliot Sober talks about equilibrium explanation, where we show how an event would have occurred regardless of a variety of different causal setups. And symmetry explanation is kind of obvious thought in physics of a kind of another kind of modal structure, explanation in terms of modal structure. Now, I put constructive theory here because I saw talked to Chiara about this before. You know, David Deutsch has this program, and he, you know, it seems to me an explicit recognition of whether or not it was a good bit of physics, I don't know. that seemed to be like an explicit recognition of the importance of modal notions in what physics tells us about the world, or interpreting what physics tells us about the world. Good. So look, I think I'm going to stop because it's 4:15 and I'm sure you'll have questions by now if you haven't fallen asleep. So over to you. Thanks a lot.
Great, shall we? Thank James for the talk. So we can, I think Lee has his hand up. So yeah, if you want to go for it. You're muted, Lee.
Yes, thank you. Two quick questions. Do you see a relationship between modal forms of explanation and the use of time, the strong use of time? That is, there are people who claim, and some of them, for example, are at some points Heisenberg or Freeman Dyson, that the wave function is a kind of modal description or possibilistic description of the future, but can never describe the past. Be that any description of the past is definite, and descriptions of the future are indefinite, and that's the distinction between quantum and classical and non-quantum physics.
Yeah, that's so interesting, Lee. I mean, I thinking a bit about Heisenberg recently, because I've been thinking about a lot about one of my students working on probabilities in quantum mechanics and the probability currents and how we interpret it and all of this. And it, you know, that stuff that Heisenberg says about how you've got some kind of bubbling potentiality that gets actualized or whatever, it's so suggestive. And it's, I mean, it makes sense, right? The problem with it is that it involves this idea of measurement and collapse and some kind of, you know, superluminal problem, right? So I have no way around that, but I totally see why Heisenberg says what he says. Now, I mentioned decoherence in my abstract, but I haven't mentioned it yet. So I would like to think that maybe the theory of decoherence could help here, that not the theory of decoherence, but the reality of decoherence could help here. And I think this is where I want to make that distinction between formal mode and material mode again, right? Decoherence theory is about, you know, diagonalizing the density matrix or, you know, whatever you do mathematically, finding an eigenbasis and all of this, right? But physically, it's like, oh no, my system decohered, right? What does an experimentalist mean by that? They mean that they lost quantum coherence, like as a experimentally measurable, determinable thing, right? Now, I would like to be a realist about decoherence. That is to think, I want to think that decoherence kind of happens in the lab when that happens. It's something that's happened to the quantum system. It's decohered. Now, if you think that, then you know, you must presumably think that there's something other than unitary time evolution happening. Well, I'm really interested in the idea of thinking about open quantum systems and thinking about how when we, you know, we don't use unitary quantum mechanics for open quantum systems, right? That the time evolution isn't unitary there. And there are these generalized approaches where you have this Schrodinger equation becomes like a special case. I'm just talking off the top of my head, right? This is how I would think that you could not end up in Everett if you're an ontic structure realist. I suppose that's my very short bit of sort of answering that bit of my abstract or speaking to that bit of my abstract.
Okay, I'll wait on the second question, but that I agree this is very interesting, and we've been trying to make sense of quantum mechanics in terms of the distinction between the past, future, and present. Maybe I can send you something about that.
Yeah, I mean, so the other thing that I was really fascinated by for some time was the time symmetric quantum mechanics. which is a very, very different way of thinking about things. So I don't have a good view. That's clear. I don't know what to think. Okay, good. Thank you. Got some more questions.
Yeah, so we had Phil and then Fanula.
Hi, thanks for giving the talk, and I'm really thankful to have been able to listen in on it. I'm coming from this from a purely like kind of philosophical perspective. And so I just want to make sure that I'm kind of understanding what motivates your ontic structural realism. And then I'm going to see if maybe there's a question in there that I could ask. So if I've understood correctly, what really motivates ontic structural realism is this notion of modal necessity, right? And I'm curious if that's modal necessity is reflective of a commitment to modal realism. And if it makes sense then to talk about ontic structural realism as maybe reducible to a kind of modal realism?
Yeah.
Or if it like, is modality itself a structure? Like, is there a prior realism here?
So the standard way of philosophers thinking about modal realism, though, is they think about it in terms of other worlds, right? So they think modal structure is the structure that we have between this world and all the other worlds. So the modal structure is like, how close are the worlds? Like, what's the closeness relation between these worlds and all that? And this is not an argument for that at all. I think that's a very, maybe unhelpful way of thinking about modality in the following sense. How do you generate your other worlds, right? In science, the way you generate other worlds is pretty straightforward. I mean, you're in some model, and the model just tells you which bits are fixed and which bits are parameters that you can change. And you generate other worlds by just changing parameters. But in the way that philosophers do it is using natural language and the principle of recombination. So this is David Lewis, you know, you generate worlds by just taking natural language predicates and just you know, I can just go, okay, there's a world where there's donkeys, there's a world where there's talking, there's a world where there's talking donkeys, right? Now, I don't think that the talking donkey is a genuine possibility. So I'm not thinking about modality in terms of that kind of way of thinking about possible worlds anyway. So the way I'm thinking about it, I guess, is that that you know, as we evolved and formed basic concepts and proto concepts, then concepts, and then scientific concepts, that is inseparable from learning how the world works, right? So the whole point of grouping things together as common is because of their common behavior, and that relates to the modal structure of things, right? What will this stuff tend to do? So science is the ongoing elaboration of that, the ongoing development of that, the more grasping of the modal structure of the world. And so our best guide to it, you know, to necessity and possibility is science, not anything like what we can generate by conceivability. So I hope that helps.
Fanula, did you want to ask your question?
Thank you for the talk. It's really interesting. So I'm not sure if I understood this statement right, but did you say that if we take a realist view of decoherence that we kind of throw away our unitary dynamics? I'm not really sure if I understood that.
Oh, let me say that again. Okay, yeah. So what I wanted to say was there's a theory of decoherence within unitary quantum mechanics, right? And so what that basically shows is, I guess you could say it shows the kind of consistency of decoherence with the formalism in a way. It shows that the process of decoherence can select a basis. But that's not the same thing as what I would regard as, I mean, not, it might match up to it, but then there's this, then there's the thing in the world, like systems decohering, which I could grasp without having any theory. I mean, even if I didn't have quantum mechanics at all, right? So my favorite example is, you know, this wonderful experiment that Zeilinger's team did with buckyballs and temperature. I don't know if any of you will know about this, where you do it, it's actually a multiple slit experiment, but pretend it's a two slit experiment. And buckyballs are these C60 molecules, right? And they heat them up. And the warmer the buckyballs, the less the interference pattern, right? And I mean, it's so good that you can kind of turn up the heat and the interference pattern turns into a bimodal, or, you know, like you go from interference to just a normal distribution opposite each slit as you turn up the heat. And this is because, I mean, the explanation is something like this. When the buckyballs are hot, then there's some energy in their structure, and then every so often they can emit a thermal photon. And if they emit roughly, I think it says in the calculation, like 3 thermal photons is enough to give you which path information on average. So if the buckyballs are emitting thermal photons, they're effectively revealing their position, and then you're losing, you know, classic kind of quantum mechanics way. That effectively, you know, if you talked about it in kind of the old way of thinking, you'd be like, well, the environment's measuring the position, so we're losing the eigenstate of momentum, which corresponds to the definite wavelength, so we lose the interference pattern. Right, now, what's interesting about this is, it's kind of a continuous process of, like, you know, you turn up the heat, you can lose the interference pattern bit by bit, you can kind of lose it a bit or lose it completely. The other thing is that no one, of course, I mean, this is the thing I always tell students about, nobody has to measure anything, right? Nobody has to catch these thermal photons and look to see where the particle was. The mere fact of them is enough to make the particle momentum state indeterminate. Now, my point is just this. Suppose you didn't know any quantum mechanics at all, but you just observed in the lab that, you know, when things got warm, you lost these nice interference patterns you were seeing. Then you'd be able to name this process decoherence. And my thought is that there are lots of experimentalists who know what decoherence is, but they don't do it via the theory of decoherence. It's just something that annoys them when it happens, you know? Something happens in the lab and it's annoying and you need to stop it happening by shielding the apparatus and all this sort of stuff, right? So my thought was, well, if I'm a realist about decoherence, if I think it really happens in a single world, so I don't, you know, I don't think of this as some kind of effective separating out of worlds like Wallace does, but I just think, no, in the real world, like, quantum systems decohere sometimes, then I can't believe that unitary quantum mechanics applies to the whole of the universe, right? Because if it did, I'd have to have Everett. So maybe the answer is, well, quantum mechanics doesn't apply to open systems. And that's how we avoid the measurement problem, because measurement problem assumes that all the dynamics is unitary. Maybe it's not. Now, the normal way of thinking about that is, well, yeah, so there's unitary evolution and then there's collapse, which breaks the unitary evolution. But maybe that's not right. I mean, maybe unitary evolution is something that we do in our models or something, and, you know, we don't need to kind of think of it as, I don't know. I don't know what to think about this. I mean, I haven't got any easy answers here. I'm just intrigued by the fact that in order to get the measurement problem, we have to assume that unitary time evolution is universal. And we only really have evidence for unitary time evolution being empirically adequate in isolated systems. And so you might think, well, I just don't have any grounds for thinking that the whole universe evolves unitarily. Like, that's going way beyond, like, the domain in which my theory has been empirically adequate up to now. So then there's the option maybe of exploring these approaches to quantum mechanics that don't, that do use a open systems kind of formalism with, or with, not with the Schrodinger equation, basically. So I don't know if that makes sense, but thanks.
Thank you. That's really interesting.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Lee, is your hand up from last time or do you have a question again? Oh, you're muted, by the way, Lee.
I'm going to resist the temptation to start talking about why there can't be a theory of the whole universe of the same type as the ones we have. Because I want to ask you about something else, which is functional explanation. Let's consider a question in physical chemistry. Why are there many more proteins of certain kinds, for example, hemoglobin, than of other kinds? There are some vast number of possible proteins, 20 to the thousand or something like that. And if we ask the question, which is a question in physical chemistry, why does hemoglobin exist in plentiful amounts while some other random one, almost all of them, in fact, don't exist? And you could imagine giving a traditional account of that in terms of the evolution of the wave function of the universe, blah, 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 blah. But the real explanation is functional. Real explanation is that hemoglobin exists because it's part of animals and it helps them move blood around so they can more efficiently act. And that doesn't contradict the fact that the laws of physics have to have been satisfied throughout the evolution of life. But the laws of physics themselves are hardly adequate to explain that question.
Good. So, and what your thought is what? I'm just thinking about your stuff from ages ago about you know, the explanation for the way the universe is being sort of analogous to that, right? That the universe is way it is because it sort of stuck around or survived or you know.
Right. Well, this is part of the evolution of thinking beyond the cosmological natural selection model, but I'm trying to kind of find an interesting space between being a completely a reductionist and being something in between that allows us to talk about biology and physics at the same time.
Interesting. I suppose, I mean, I just want to make one slightly, maybe pessimistic thought, is that I can see reasons why you might think that a science of the whole universe would be impossible, which is that, you know, we just don't have epistemic access to other universes. And so, and we've been trying to sort of observe the universe from inside it. And yet, so I think that, I mean, that one reason why we can't kind of describe the whole universe might be we haven't found the right way of doing it, but.
Yes, no, excuse me, Jane. I'm not making a claim that science of the universe is impossible. I'm making the claim that the physics of the whole universe would have to be based on different kinds of methodologies and principles than the science of isolated systems of the universe.
Right. Well, that makes sense because, I mean, this is the really weird thing about physics. How did physics become a historical science, right? That's the weird thing, isn't it? I mean, yeah. You know, I was saying to a student earlier, actually, you know, if you think about it now in biology, every explanation implicates you in sort of 4 billion years of life on Earth. Every explanation is essentially at some level historical and involves this history of evolutionary selection. Now, prior to knowing the facts about how biology goes, I mean, you might well have said before that that this is not the kind of explanation you want at all, and that this is not, doesn't count, and it's no good. And, you know, when we do science, we learn enough about the world to find out what kinds of explanations we can, in fact, give. I mean, now, the thing about the physics is it's always been able to be ahistorical, because you're studying isolated systems, and you're studying them as they are now. But as you say, when you study the universe, it seems that there's two things about that are different to most physics. One, it's like studying a specific object in the same way that geology studies there's exogeology, I'm sure, but it studies the Earth, right? That it doesn't study anything else. Like, it's like the physics of the solar system is about the solar system. So it's got a single object. But then the other thing is, it's like it's a historical science in the sense that that's an evolved thing. And I mean, certainly if you hear that, if you believe the kind of gloss that people give on the standard story about symmetry breaking in the early universe or whatever, that there's this contingent history, right? Yeah. So in that sense, I think I would agree with you that you can't, it's not obvious you can study it in the same way at all. But I mean, the thing that I find really interesting is that when you think about it, every science has its own way of forming a system and then having the environment. And there are all these notions of closed. So I was writing a grant application on open and closed systems, and somebody thought about it, but it's actually different, really different. You can have closed in the sense of no matter goes in and out. That's chemically closed, right? So, then you've got closed in the thermodynamically closed, like no heat flow, right? So you've got, economics would have its own idea of like endogenous versus exogenous factors or whatever within some different domain, right? So every science has got to find a way of kind of going, here's the system, there's the rest of the world, and now we want to sort of think of the rest of the world a bit like a heat bath, It's just kind of, it's not relevant. We're just studying the system, and then we're going to study the flows across the boundary, or whatever happens on the boundary. And the rest of the universe doesn't matter apart from how it performs on the boundary. And we can think, but in order to do that, you're totally idealizing the world as a completed entity, right? That you can just think of it as an object, and then split it into two parts, environment plus system. But it's not obvious to me that that's really how it is, right? That, if, I don't know what I'm saying, but these are profound matters about which it's best not to say too much, or you just start talking nonsense or repeating yourself.
Lee, you're muted.
I think we have to try to talk about this question, but I won't take up more of your time now.
Okay. Philippe, did you want to ask a question? And Rob also, you had a question. Yes, after Philippe, we'll go to Rob.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot for the talk. It was very interesting. I want to ask a question to see if I understand properly, like, what's the thing being claimed with this ontic structural realism. So it's like you have this idea of modal structure that is the thing that is preserved across a theory change, and it explains why you can be realist despite the fact that theories appear to change a lot. But there seems to be like this skeptical argument that is possible, that you could say, okay, since modal structure is a counterfactual thing, and all we have access is the actual, then perhaps you could have theory change that changes a lot the counterfactual structure, but just changes it in places that are not actualized, so that everything that has happened happens, but if it had been different, they would have been very different. And are you making somehow the claim that, and this seems unreasonable in a way, no, but so I don't know if I believe that this is a good argument, but are you somehow claiming it's not like this also?
No. I don't think I've got any less grounds for skepticism than anybody else or anything new to add about that. I mean, that's always possible, like whatever we think about laws or whatever, right? That it's always possible we got our laws wrong, or the laws are going to only hold in some region of the universe, and the laws are all going to change in 5 minutes' time or whatever. And I haven't got anything new to say about any of that. I mean, the other thing I would say is I'm not quite saying modal structure is, I just want to make it really clear. I'm not saying there's this thing called modal structure is preserved. What I'm saying is in cases where there's radical theory change, you can identify modal structure that is preserved. That's not the same thing as saying for all modal structure is preserved, right? It's just I just emphasize this because the dialectical position here is so important, right? The dialectical position is the anti-realist coming with theory change and saying, look, this is a real problem for you. And then what structural realism is doing is saying, look, I can identify all these continuities, it's okay, right? But we're not saying, and the kinds of continuities we've identified, those things are always and entirely preserved or anything like that. And of course, the modal structure of quantum, of Newtonian physics, I mean, if it was, if it was completely preserved, then, well, I mean, apart from anything else, I mean, if it was right, Mercury wouldn't be where it is. And, you know, this obviously, like I said, it says that, you know, when you accelerate when you give a clock a boost and then bring it back to a clock, but it will still say the same time, right? So just want to emphasize that. But yeah, thanks for your question. And like, I suppose that maybe the longer I do philosophy is the more I think that philosophers often set themselves problems where it's almost like the scientists haven't answered this problem, but somehow we're going to answer it for them. And then we fail to do it and then beat ourselves up about it or something. Whereas I just think we shouldn't be trying. I mean, the project of describing the modal structure of the world is science. Right? I might contribute to that, but if I do so, I'll be doing so qua scientist, like really, not qua philosopher, if you know what I mean. This is all about interpretation. Oh, hold on, I'm just going to see if this is urgent. I just didn't know if that was an unknown number in my son's school or something. So, excuse me. Sorry, please. Any more questions?
Can I just, like, as a follow-up to this, are you, it's not very big or popular, but there's these people working on trying to use Kolmogorov complexity concepts to basically make statements only about the actual. No, so it's like a notion of randomness that only involves recorded data and not sort of counterfactual data. I'm just wondering if you have an opinion about this.
Not really, but I mean, I know the Kolmogorov complexity isn't computable, so you can't actually do it in practice, can you? But can you estimate it, or?
Well, you can lower bound it.
Right.
Or up. Upper bound.
I don't have a comment about that. I mean, I wrote this book on complexity science, and we looked a lot at measures of complexity, and we argued that they are not usually measures of complexity as such. They're measures of something else, usually like order or something, some other feature of complex systems. But no, I don't have anything much more to say than that about that. I mean, I do think the problem of what is random is a really, really interesting one. What randomness means. I think that's another case where there's kind of material mode and formal mode, right? So formal mode, like randomness, is like Kolmogorov complexity, or all these different ideas of how you define what randomness is, some distribution or string or whatever. But actually, you know, kind of, it's quite interesting, because if you kind of go from a more kind of scientific end, more practical end, people will just tell you, well, random is what paradigmatically random stochastic processes do, right? So the way that, there's two ways to define random. I mean, one is to go all that theoretical stuff, and the other is to like point at the stock market and say, look, random walk, or Brownian motion, or radioactive decay, or some other paradigmatically stochastic process within science. And I think it's really interesting. Like we seem to be unable to fully explicitly characterize what we mean by random, but still need the idea. Yeah. You know, I did this, so tell you a kind of funny anecdote, but I did a project on homotopy type theory, which is this thing in mathematics, computer science, I think. But it was all comes from the work of this guy called Per Martinlov. Have you heard of Martinlov? And he's a Swedish guy. Yes. And he ended up inventing this type theory, but the way that he did so was that it all started with bird watching, right? So he was interested in bird watching. So he wrote a paper about the migration patterns of birds. But then he realized that he was having to make inferences about the migration patterns of birds from his samples. So then he got interested in the idea of sampling and random sampling. And then he started wondering what random meant. So then he did his PhD with Kolmogorov on the definition of random, and ended up trying to define randomness in terms of typicality. And then realized that that basically this was to define randomness in terms of a part in terms of the whole, and that meant that his definition of randomness was impredicative. And then he was led to try to develop a predicative type theory out of like the design. So I just like the story, because it's like the pathway of like Wittgenstein or something. It starts with aeronautical engineering and ends up with truth tables. You know, it sort of like starts with something incredibly practical, but then just keeps going, yeah, but what does that mean, until you end up with it's like Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell said, I began with an interest in certain problems in classical mechanics and was led to an investigation of the meaning of the word any.
But I don't know what Thanks. The problem is. 17 is the most random number.
Because?
Oh, come on. Everybody knows that.
No, I don't. I don't know. I've had it before.
Okay.
We have Rob, I think, had a question, then Angela.
So I have a question. I guess it's a question I've had for a long time about ontic structural realism. And it's about a kind of resemblance between ontic structural realism and a similar idea, I think, which I believe, I mean, it plays a big role in mathematics and is playing a bigger role in physics today. And I mean, maybe I've just never come across a discussion of this connection. So I'll sort of explain what I mean, and then maybe you can tell me how the ideas are connected. So I'm thinking of kind of the trend in mathematics to sort of, rather than have a set theoretic foundation, to use category theory. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, that trend is also about sort of upplaying structural relations and downplaying the relata that bear those structural relations. So, you know, in particular, if I think of like the development of non-Euclidean geometry, where people for a long time, you know, thought they could prove the parallel postulate by, you know, deriving theorems that are sort of, you know, repugnant to the nature of a line, and that, you know, that's the proof. Whereas eventually it was realized that, you know, the meaning of concepts like points and lines ultimately is determined by the axioms in which they're embedded. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's not as if there's this God-given thing of points and lines and we all know what they mean, and now we have to figure out how they're related to one another. It's rather that, you know, the entities themselves, you know, get their meaning from the axioms that they're embedded in. And so I think in physics, we see more and more of this, but I think it's there also in the paradigm shift, in a lot of paradigm shifts in physics. So if I think of relativity, I would say like you could have imagined somebody saying, you know, that you just couldn't do that because there's certain analytic truths about the nature of space and time that you just can't violate. Whereas, you know, it was the fact that Einstein allowed the notions of space and time to be determined by the axioms in which they were embedded and therefore be modified that allowed relativity theory to develop. So I think it was a very structural approach to how to do physics. And so I think, you know, in a lot of places in physics, we have that attitude where it's kind of like non-Euclidean geometry. You let your concepts be flexible. You don't presume that there's analytic truths about them and you kind of let it respond. So I mean, I see a lot of that in physics and in particular in quantum theory these days. And so I'm just curious to what extent ontic structural realism is really the same kind of claim as this claim of a sort of category theoretic foundation rather than a set theoretic foundation.
Well, okay, so I just want to separate several things here, right? So this is a very, very interesting question. So first thought is that there's something more basic, I think, than ontic structural realism for me, which is naturalism, right? Where naturalism is basically just deferring to science, right, very crudely, for our knowledge of the world. Now, what you're talking about is what I would regard as the process of conceptual creativity within science, where we learn to change our concepts and develop our concepts to make them more apt to describing the world. And past questions often don't get answered. They just get rendered irrelevant. And we've got a whole load of new questions that we didn't even know were there that we start asking. And I don't want to claim that for structural realism, right? I mean, that like everybody can believe in that, whether or not you're a structural realist. But it is, in my mind, like both are supposed to come out of the spirit of naturalism, right? So one of the things that drives me mad about philosophy is conceptual conservatism and a kind of insistence on, yeah, but what does this mean in terms of these old concepts that we've got? And I just want to say, well, what it means is that your concepts aren't apt and you need new ones, right? And I think a really good example of this is the field, the concept of the field. I mean, it just comes into physics. It's not there before. There are concepts of ether, but they're not the same concept. And then it becomes indispensable. And now you just can't do physics without talking about fields. It'd be mad to try it. Or force is another brilliant example, you know. So conceptual innovation, conceptual, you know, progress is what we've always done up to now. And, you know, presumably we should carry on doing it. So that's just general point. Now, there's something more specific you're saying about, so the thought in mathematics, I mean, is something like this, you know, mathematical objects are given up to the relevant class of morphisms. And all we know is structure in math. So if I say the Euclidean plane, it sounds like I'm talking about a thing because I use the definite article, right? And within geometry, I mean, the Euclidean plane is a thing because it's not the hyperbolic plane and it's not the surface of the sphere, it's the Euclidean plane. And that's a kind of, we all know what that structure is, right? But equally, it's perfectly possible for me to say, consider a Euclidean plane and consider another Euclidean plane and consider the line of their intersection, right? So in one way, you know, Euclidean plane just is its structure. In the other way, I can have one Euclidean plane and another Euclidean plane. It makes it seem like it's more than that. And this is a sort of tension in maths all the time where, you know, we say that the things are only structural, but we're somehow allowed to, I can sort of say, consider the point P in the Euclidean plane and now consider a distinct point Q. Now, how on earth am I supposed to sort of think about P when P is identical to every other point in the Euclidean plane, right? Well, this is sort of, it's all terribly mysterious, but it does seem right to say that maths is considers its objects up to some sort of class of morphisms, and those are structure preserving. But what kind of structure? Well, the kind of structure that we have in that domain. So topological spaces are given up to homeomorphism, and differential manifolds are given up to diffeomorphism, and you know, and that is very much the category theoretic way of thinking. And interestingly, you know, this homotopy type theory program that I worked on is related to this, because in it you have this equivalence between equivalence, which is sort of like isomorphism, but not exactly the same thing, and identity. So it seems to be sort of really, you know, what's the word? Making this a matter of principle that identity just is sameness of structure. Whether or not that as a program for doing physics is the right way to go, I don't know. I know that loads of philosophers of physics now are really interested in category theory too. And I think this is a really interesting area for future work for people to think about. It's like, how will we rethink about the foundations of physics if we rethink the foundations of maths, if we move from set theoretic extensional foundations to maybe category theoretic or type theoretic, maybe intentional foundations? So I certainly think it's interesting. And everything what I think, we should be trying out new things, right? I mean, that's, so, yeah.
Let me ask, I'm realizing as you're speaking that maybe a good example of the kind of thing that this mathematical sort of structuralism suggests to me is this Kuhnian idea that, again, sort of it's sort of concept based, but you know the meaning of a term like electron is not something that's sort of intrinsic to the electron, but it's more about the theory that it's embedded in, right?
Yeah, so
the idea is that if you change your theory, then you know that the very meanings of the terms are changing because you know they're embedded in this different theory. So that feels to me like I wouldn't have to give up on the existence of electrons per se and say, well, it was just wrong to presume that ontology, but rather kind of our notion of the ontology changes with the theory that it's embedded in, because ontology is always defined, you know, the meanings of terms, ontological terms, just like anything else, is ultimately defined by the theory that they're embedded in.
Right.
So does ontic structuralism conflict with or support this sort of Kuhnian view of the meanings of concepts?
Okay, good. So a couple of things to say. I mean, one is the Kuhnian view is radical, because the Kuhnian view goes with this kind of Kantianism, right? Where there's sort of different worlds depending on your conceptual scheme or something. That view, though, the idea that the meaning of a term is defined by its functional role within a theory, that was the subject of this famous paper by David Lewis called How to Define Theoretical Terms in 1971. And it's very, very influential in philosophy. And, you know, it's commonly deployed in relation to philosophy of mind, where people will say something like, look, pain is as pain does. That's what enables me to think that, how can it be intelligible to me that there could be, I could meet a race of Martians and end up concluding that they feel pain, even though they might have some completely different physiological basis for it. And you kind of think, well, but if it was related to bodily damage and aversion behavior and an unpleasant situation, and we tended to want to avoid it and all these things, then it would be pain. And even though it's realized by some completely different physical mechanism, or indeed mollusk pain, which apparently is completely different to vertebrate pain. So that's a very general idea. And I think it's one that, like, it's lots of people think that's right. The problem with it is, and this is, I mean, there's lots more details here I'm skipping over, but the problem is when you think that, the problem is what the logical positivists end up arguing is that there's the surplus content of theoretical terms too. and that that can't be eliminated. So when there was this project to explicitly define things like electron by the logical positivists, they ended up concluding that it couldn't be done because there were heuristics and modeling methods and ways of thinking that physicists used in deploying these concepts which weren't captured by their place in the current theory, and that, that there's this extra content. And that that's something that realists want to talk about, so they can say, yeah, that extra content is what links electrons in the past to electrons now. So now we can, that's what makes it make sense to say that we've got a different concept of the same thing rather than a new concept of a new thing. So what does that mean? Yes, I'm kind of sympathetic, but I'm not sure how much it's really got to do with structuralism in a way. Maybe it's a bit of an orthogonal issue. I mean, yeah. I mean, this is all very much in the prehistory of, I mean, it's all stuff that I was reading when I was first thinking about structuralism. You see, the David Lewis thing, how to define theoretical terms, what he does is he says, well, given an old language, I can now functionally define terms in terms of that old language. He explains how you can introduce new terms, basically. I can't remember what I was about to say then. I might come back to you in a minute. I'm just going to go quiet then. I mean, it's what David Wallace does with probability, by the way, right? So David Wallace says probability just is what probability does. He has this functionalist theory of probability, and that's how he explains how there can be probability in an Everettian universe where everything happens. So it's central to his account of probability in Everett that we take probability just to be defined by its functional role in our theorizing. The thing I was going to say was that I think we should always come back to, you know, the thing that transcends all of this is the world, right? The world just does what it does. It doesn't care what we call it or how we describe it. And so Priestley thought that if you heated red mercury, you got dephlogisticated air. And we think that... it's oxygen. But everyone will agree that if you breathe this gas, you will have, as Priestley says, a kind of pleasant, exhilarated feeling. That's got to be the common ground that enables us to translate between these different conceptual schemes, is that we can refer to the world. And I can say, you might be a phlogiston theorist, I might be a... oxygen theorist, but I can say, okay, get the stuff that you call virtuous wool and mix it with that other stuff you call such and stuff. That gas that you get there, that's what I'm calling hydrogen, right? So, you know, we can tie things back to the world in the end, and that's where I would really resist the Kuhnian overall philosophy, I think, because it's too... it's too sort of subjectivist for me, really.
Thanks for that. Let me just respond just a little bit, which is that I think I disagree with that last claim, because I just don't think there's any way of getting out of the fact that observations are theory laden, and if different theories commit you to different conceptual schemes, we can't necessarily have agreement on what the observations are. So I don't think that there's some ability to adjudicate between conceptual schemes just by, you know, consulting the world. The world is only through, you know, the lens of our theories.
Let me say something about this. Right? So I have this phrase that I've been using quite a bit, which is theory ladenness is a feature, not a bug. Now, absolutely right that everything's theory laden, but if your theories are true, then it's good for things to be theory laden. So I think I totally agree that, you know, you can't sort of sit down and do one experiment to choose between this and that. But I think you can look at the evolution of whole research programs and say, look, this research program has developed by acquiring more and more reliable beliefs and using those beliefs to generate more reliable beliefs and to eliminate errors from previous views. And this other research program isn't progressive and doesn't go anywhere. And so I don't think we need a kind of theory neutral place to stand to adjudicate them. But, you know, of course, Kuhn himself thinks that there are like paradigm transcendent values, such as what they called accuracy, scope. He gives five, I can't remember the exact terms he uses now, but he gives five kind of virtues which he thinks of paradigm transcendent, always good in all science of all paradigms. The only problem is that we can't weight them and rank them in such a way as to give us a kind of calculus to choose between theories or between paradigms. But I think that there's loads and loads that Kuhn's wrong about. And this chemical revolution is a case in point. So we could talk more about that another time. But I think it's a very good story to be told about why the phlogiston theory is wrong and the oxygen theory is correct. I mean, really, the right answer to that is because there wasn't a phlogiston theory, because once the evidence came into a certain point, the phlogistonists themselves couldn't agree how to account for it. They kept having to change their theories to account for different data. And there was no single phlogiston theory. Once you start, you know, it's all very well to have a theory and you've got three data points, but you now add in that extra data point and now it becomes harder to account for it. And once more experimental knowledge was in, I think by the end of the 18th century, by 1790, it really was totally right to say that the oxygen theory was better.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, Andrew has a question, so it could be potentially the last question after James, yeah, depending on your other, how much more you want to discuss, we can see.
Hi, thank you very much for the talk. I've actually been reading a lot of your work and French's work for my project. Just to give you a little bit about where I'm coming from, I am looking at the possibility of applying a structuralism to biology. So because I like the, it makes sense to me, especially considering the nature of biological objects, if you want to call them objects, that a structuralist view would be more consistent with how biologists work in their field. So my question is a little bit more about the difference between your theory of ontic structuralism and von Frassen's the structural empiricism. As I was going through it, I was just kind of wondering, so if I'm accurate in understanding this, the theory of evolution is kind of like this modal structure, if I'm understanding this correctly, or natural selection, whichever one you want to so like this natural selection gives you this modal structure and then you have your possibilities that come out of it. I was just wondering, like, how is that different from saying that the theory of natural selection is just like a really good accurate predictor, you know, empirical predictor of what's going on? Yeah, so like, because you said that like you're basing your theory on a naturalism, I'm just curious, like,
yeah, how's that different?
Doesn't that naturalism assume your realism?
Yeah, kind of. And I agree with you. Like, I mean, it's not really that different from it being a good predictor. But I mean, the whole point about being a good predictor is I've got to be able to predict under different circumstances. And that means it's got to be modal. It's not just, you know, so, I mean, modeling the pandemic, you know, you want to be like, okay, suppose we do this degree of lockdown, roughly what kind of shape spike will we get? We do this other degree of lockdown, what roughly shape spike will we get? It's no good being able to predict the actual future because we want to use theories to decide what to make the future like, right? So we can't tell the theory what the actual future is going to be. We're using the theory to help us make the future. Yeah, it's very interesting. So Joe Dewhurst is a person who's done some stuff on biology and structuralism and idea of real patterns. And someone who's quite, I think, deep and interesting on these sort of very big philosophical questions that you're all raising, but especially the ones about sort of being inside the world and then having prediction and so on from the point of view of knowing in it, about bits of it, whatever, is Janaan Ismail. Now, I don't agree with her, I don't think, but I just wanted to mention her stuff because I think she's someone who's got very interesting things to say and thought really hard about this.
Sorry, what was that name again?
Janaan Ismail. She's at she's at Columbia now.
Okay, thank you.
Ismael, Janaan. But yeah, you know, let me know how you get on with structuralism and biology. And I probably somewhere got a list of more sort of relevant sources that I could I could tell you about if you wanted to talk another time.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just like really troubled by whether it actually is an ontic structural realism or whether it's von Fressen's constructive empiricism.
Right, good. So whether it's structural empiricism or ontic structural realism depends on when you go for objective modality. That's
okay.
That's it. Right. Problem with constructive empiricism, it mentions the notion of the observable, and it raises it to the status of a fundamental kind of principle, right? Or raises it status to being involved in a fundamental principle, right? So the fundamental principle is that the aim of science is empirical adequacy, and empirical adequacy means truth with respect to the observable, according to Van Frassen. And observable, according to me, and I wrote about this back in 2000 in the BJPS, it was in my PhD thesis. Not just according to me, I mean, observable is a modal notion.
Okay.
Because you have to say that dinosaurs are observable, according to Van Frassen. But no one's ever actually observed one, or will, probably, I assume. So question is whether Van Frassen's views about modality are compatible with a principled stance on science that depends on a modal notion. And I say no.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
But you could go a different way and just sort of try and work out how to be a structural empiricist without saying anything about observability. So you could still, you know, you could just go, well, I don't want the objective modality. I don't need observability. So how am I going to kind of do Van Frassen type empiricist, being maybe some kind of anti-realist about modality, empiricist in some way, but not make a big deal of the observable? I don't think it makes any sense to make a big deal of the observable. In fact, I think that science has largely proceeded by eliminating human observation in an essential way. So yes, it's essential for human knowledge that somebody reads the readout of the thermometer, but it really doesn't matter if they read that readout in Braille or with their eyes. So whilst human observation kind of obviously must be in the chain to get from the world to our brains, at least for the moment, until it's all being Bluetoothed into our cerebral cortexes and whatever, it's not playing an essential role qua like that particular kind of observational modality, medium, you know, sight or sound. In fact, I would say it's playing a role quite information channel from the world. Like that's what, according to me, empiricism should really be. It should be the view that you only get knowledge by opening an information channel to the world. The senses are information channels to the world, but we can make our information channels such that actual particular form of human sensation that figures is not essential to the output. And that's exactly what we usually do in order to get objectivity in science.
That makes sense, especially considering the like science that I'm looking at, because they download a bunch of weather data from a sensor and a computer, and then they model it with the computer, and then they make their conclusions and observations about what's happening, right?
Yeah, observation here does not mean, observation doesn't mean something you saw with your eyes, not in any important way.
Awesome, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I think we've kind of bombarded lots of questions at James for quite a while now, so we should probably...
I could do a stopping. I just say Thomas at the beginning, I wanted to have a really kind of worked up talk specifically for you lot, and I just didn't. I've been so busy, it's been a total nightmare. And so I really relied upon my ability to sort of talk about my stuff rather than really polishing and preparing specifically for you. So apologies that I perhaps could have been a bit slicker. Hopefully it was worth your while anyway.
Yeah, no, I think it worked great, this format, because there's lots of questions and back and forth. So I think, the kind of fluid format is great. So maybe we should thank James again. Yeah, like kind of clapping
hands. Thanks, everybody. Hope to see you all in real life one day.
Yeah.
Some of you. All right. Thanks a lot, Thomas, for organising this. And thanks for those who came and your questions and everything. Hope it was helpful. Thanks very much.